A master of crime fiction channels Ian Fleming in a new James Bond novel.
My job is to be Fleming, or to try and be as good as Fleming, or to be as similar to Fleming as I can be. And also, I'm very much living in his world. These are his characters. It's his period, his timeline, his structure, his tropes and mannerisms, his world. It's an interesting and difficult experience to explain, but it isn't me writing. It is me channeling.
That's Anthony Horowitz. We talk with him about his new thriller, Forever and a Day. It's the backstory to 007, James Bond. Then we talk with Maxine Rosaller about her story collection, Queen for a Day. It's a poignant, trenchant, and funny exploration of life with an autistic son. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rihanna. Anthony Horowitz is one of the best-known crime novelists writing in the English language today. He's the author of the popular Alex Rider series for young readers and screenwriter for the long-running BBC series Foyle's War, among other writings for print, screen, and stage. We last talked with him about his book, The Word is Murder, a brilliant and instructive romp through the classic tropes of crime fiction. Horowitz has also written several novels in the style of his forebears, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, with the Sherlock Holmes novels Moriarty and House of Silk, and Ian Fleming, with his James Bond novel Trigger Mortis. Now, Horowitz is out with a new Bond novel that gives the backstory to the dashing secret agent, the story of what made Bond 007. It's called Forever and a Day, and we called up Anthony Horowitz at his home in the UK to find out more about it. So, Anthony Horowitz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's a real pleasure to be talking to you a second time. I loved it the last time, as I recall.
Oh, yeah, and I did too. It was wonderful. So this book, Forever in a Day, is your second James Bond novel, the first being Trigger Mortis. How did you first get into doing these Bond books?
Well, it's sort of a long story. I have been a fan of James Bond since I was about 10 or 11 years old, the films and the books. And when the Ian Fleming estate started hiring new writers to write new Bond novels, starting with Sebastian Faulks and then moving on to Jeffrey Deaver and then William Boyd, I got more and more sort of agitated because I was saying to myself, why wouldn't they ring me? I mean, this is what I've wanted to do pretty much all my life. And I even sent out sort of smoke signals to them. Every time I wrote an article in a newspaper, I'd somehow try and mention how much I would love to write a Bond novel. And after William Boyd's book, about 6 months went past, and then quite suddenly the phone rang, and somehow the Ian Fleming estate had picked up on the signals, and they hired me. So that's how it happened.
Oh, that's terrific. And, you know, in the past you've written novels that were, let's say, inspired by Agatha Christie. What's different about the novels that are in the style of Ian Fleming?
Well, the continuation novels that I'm best known for are probably the two Sherlock Holmes books I did, The House of Silk and Moriarty. I haven't really written so much in the style of Agatha Christie, although I have written a lot of Agatha Christie adaptations on television, and my book Magpie Murders borrows quite a lot from Agatha Christie. Writing Ian Fleming is very peculiar, and I mean that it's very unique, it's very unusual. Fleming has a very difficult style to pin down, because his novels are much better written and more cleverly written, I think, than people might know. You know, we confuse the movies and the books and think they're the same. The books aren't. They're very beautifully written. The atmosphere in the books, the sense of what Fleming calls acidity, which is a sort of a tiredness, a sense of cynicism almost, a forbidding, foreboding quality about the world. That's what's in the descriptions in the Bond novels. Then you get the action sequences, which are spectacular. If you look at the toboggan chase in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, or the Venice sequence in From Russia with Love, or whatever, you know, the nobody writes action as well as Fleming. And then you've got the extraordinary set pieces, the girl painted gold, or Bond tied down with a circular saw, you know, rotating and moving slowly between his legs, or even the game of golf, which he plays with Goldfinger, or the game of bridge he plays with Hugo Drax. Fleming has the ability to conjure up these astonishing scenes. So to try and imitate him, to try and be as good as him, is very difficult indeed.
And so, well, you actually had some work of his in writing this book and in writing Forever and a Day. You used some original material, and also did you use some original material in Trigger Mortis?
I did indeed, yes. There were some scripts that Ian Fleming was going to write. He wrote Treatment for a TV series. It was going to be produced in America for MGM, I think, at the end of the 1950s. But the TV series got scuppered because the movies came along, and so they were shelved, and all these treatments or story outlines were sort of just forgotten. Fleming himself used two or three of them for his own short story collections, For Your Eyes Only and Octopussy. But the other ones sort of got left in a drawer, more or less, and the Fleming estate came upon them almost by chance, just after William Boyd had finished writing his book. So when I wrote Trigger Mortis, they suggested to me that I should use one of these story outlines as part of the book. In Trigger Mortis, it's a story called Murder on Wheels, which has Bond entering the world of Formula One racing, which is sort of incredibly dangerous, particularly at that time in the 1950s. It was a lethal sport, and glamorous and exciting and fast, but very, very dangerous too. So perfect for Bond. And that was the one I chose for Trigger Mortis. When it came to Forever and a Day, it was a little more difficult. I chose a story called Russian Roulette, which is set in a casino in Monte Carlo. And it fitted the story very well, because my own story takes place in the south of France and does have a casino and does have a game of cards in it. So that was the correct area. The story that I used was much thinner than the one that I had used in Trigger Mortis. There's no dialogue in it. There's no description in it. It is very much a sort of a thumbnail sketch. Even so, in both books, I've already said that it is quite a challenge to sort of raise my game to Fleming's level. But in both books, I feel sort of comfortable in the knowledge that no matter what everybody says about the rest of the book, there is a little part of each one that is real Fleming and has his language in it and his ideas. And you know, I always want to say, you know, the book is worth buying if only for that.
Yeah, so let me ask you, did you feel that in some way you were channeling Ian Fleming in, you know, getting inside his head to be able to write this book in his style? Or were you able to preserve your own authorial kind of identity? And was there a challenge in doing that?
Well, I think my job as a continuation novelist is to lose my authorial identity, if that's what you want to call it, because my job is to be Fleming, or to try and be as good as Fleming, or to be as similar to Fleming as I can be. And also, I'm very much living in his world. These are his characters. It's his period, his timeline, his structure, his tropes and mannerisms, his world. So I don't want to interfere by imposing my own personality and my own ideas into the book. You use the word channeling. Do I channel Ian Fleming? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very good word, because that's exactly what I'm trying to do. When I'm writing these books, whether it's Doyle or Fleming, I start by rereading the original material, which actually in both cases means not a lot of reading, because, you know, there are only 11 or so James Bond novels and about 60 Sherlock Holmes short stories. But I read the entire canon again, and I try to sort of immerse myself. I try to sort of understand what each author is doing. And then it is sort of a channeling. In each case, I had a signed autograph by them. I have a book with a signature in it by Fleming and one by Doyle. And even having something of them in the room with me makes me feel that they have a presence there, that they're almost watching over my shoulder as I write. It's an interesting and difficult experience to explain, but it isn't me writing. It is me channeling. And I think your choice of word is exactly right.
Well, that must be really exciting and a little bit strange.
It's not strange in a way, because I love these books. You know, I think that when children read books, and I get this a lot with kids who read my Alex Rider books, they don't just read them, they live them, they breathe them, they immerse themselves in them, and they live almost exclusively inside the adventure. And if you're an adult and you want to have that same feeling, writing a continuation novel does give it to you because, you know, when I'm writing Bond, I am in his world. I'm standing next to him. I'm looking at him. I don't want to sound pretentious in this conversation, but that is, you know, I spend a lot of time on my own in a room, and it is how I feel, this sort of sense of this now is my world.
And also, his world, of course, was the world of 1953, immediate post-war period. Of course, the roots of James Bond are in the war. Did you also have to do a lot of research about, you know, the war and the period after that?
Well, I am fortunate, having written Foyle's War for so many years, I'm fairly well steeped in what happened between 1940 and about 1947 anyway, so that part of it. And I have also done a lot of research into Fleming's life and his work in naval intelligence, and I have a fascination with Special Operations Executive, which is a sort of world of guerrilla warfare and gadgets and all that sort of stuff, which Churchill set up at the beginning of the war and which Fleming was very much connected to and from which James Bond comes. So I do have a sort of a grounding in the period. I was born in 1955, so it's just a little bit before my time, but I sort of feel connected to it. That said, I do have to do a great deal of research, and one of the sort of annoyances of writing a book like Forever and a Day is having to stop whenever you get to, I don't know, a cocktail or a car or a shirt or a pair of shoes or a perfume, and sort of trying to work out, was it there in 1953? Would this woman have worn it? And what would Bond think of it? It's not just a question of checking in a newspaper or on the internet that such and such pair of shoes existed in 1953. It's always with Fleming, because he was a bit of a snob about these things. Are they the right pair of shoes? So, you know, it is always having to stop and start and look into what is correct. But it is fortunate, but there are a great many websites around, I even acknowledge one of them in the back of the book, that deal exclusively with these questions. You know, what cocktail does Bond drink? What cigarette does he smoke? What car does he drive, etc.?
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Anthony Horowitz about his latest thriller and second James Bond novel, Forever and a Day. It's just been published in the U.S. by HarperCollins. So now, Forever and a Day is actually a prequel to Fleming's first Bond novel, Casino Royale, which was published in 1953. This is a kind of backstory. Why did you want to do the backstory?
It seems to me, this is the first thing, it seems to me that if you're going to write a James Bond book as opposed to a movie, and incidentally, I'm not criticizing Jeffrey Deaver or William Boyd, who do not agree with this, but in my view, for my books, they have to be in the correct period. That is to say, they have to take place between about 1953 and sort of the early 60s, which is when the main James Bond canon takes place. I think Bond is inseparable from that period. So if you then go to the books and look at the main adventures and try and work out when can your story happen, you have to look for gaps. You have to look for gaps in the action. So, for example, Trigger Mortis takes place just a few weeks after Bond has defeated Goldfinger, and Pussy Galore is even living with him in his London apartment, and it sort of follows on, you know, and continues almost their relationship and the adventure. When I came to write the next one, I was looking for another gap, and it occurred to me that the best and most obvious gap was the one before Casino Royale, because, of course, it stretches back as long as you want. So I set the book about, I don't know, 3, maybe 4 months before Casino Royale, which gave me the opportunity, first of all, to have a blank canvas and to know that he wasn't busy doing other things, but also to start looking at some of the things that make James Bond James Bond. And that's what the book really is about. It's about what turns a man from being a spy and a functionary of government into becoming the very, very hard-edged, cold-blooded killer that we know from the books. What happened to him that made him, as it were, lose some of his humanity? And that's what the book, that was the story I decided to write.
Right, and so famously, 007, like the other numbers in his department, I guess, men who have these numbers, they have a license to kill, and this book is about him kind of getting his license to kill. At a certain point, he's asked if he's a psychopath. I mean, he's already killed twice, as the story starts, as kind of part of, I guess, his training for this department. What's your take on, you know, does he have to be a kind of psychopath? What is the justification for license?
I don't think Bond is a psychopath. I don't think that's what he is at all. And although he may be asked if he is, or I think somebody taunts him with the fact that only two people kill without any sort of feeling, one is a spy, the other is a psychopath, somebody says to him in the book. But I don't think of him as a psychopath exactly. No, I mean, he's doing his duty. I mean, taking those two killings, just to start with, it's interesting that in Casino Royale he does talk about the two killings that earned him his 007 license. The first one was a shot into a skyscraper in New York, and the second one was a silent killing, which was bloody and brutal, which took place in Stockholm. That's all we know about them, and I was able to build on that. That's on what Fleming had given us. And I think it's interesting that when he does the killing that we start the book with, which is an assassination in Stockholm, it is messy and bloody and it's rather horrible. And to a certain extent, Bond doesn't do it properly. As the story develops, you realize that he's actually done something wrong. And he isn't yet a proficient killer, but that's what this book is about. It is about the first time and how it changes you, even that experience itself. I mean, I would have hoped very much that nobody listening to this has ever had to kill another human being, but it must make a fantastic psychological change in you to have done that, this greatest of all crimes, although, of course, for Bond, it is not a crime, it's a duty. And, you know, the rest of the book is develops his rationale, his mind, and then the book finishes with another kill. And I think what's interesting in the book is the difference between the first kill and the last kill and what has happened on the way.
This also takes place during the, you know, in the Cold War world. And, you know, there would have been a time, I mean, there was a time, let's say, when Cold War spy novels were kind of going out of style because it was, you know, post-détente and the Soviet Union had collapsed. Would you say that this Cold War world is newly relevant?
I think the Cold War has come back to us, hasn't it? I mean, that's what it looks like now, with Vladimir Putin in Moscow, with, you know, with the Mueller inquiry into Russian influence on the American election, with spies everywhere saying different stories about what may or may not have happened in the past, with a possibility that Russians were involved in the Brexit election over here, you know, the Brexit manifesto over here. We seem to be back in another Cold War. We had only recently, and it was straight out of James Bond, a poisoning in the market town of Salisbury here, where, you know, one of the deadliest nerve agents known to man was used to kill an agent in Salisbury. That's straight out of a James Bond novel, and all the more shocking because it's real life. So I think that writing Cold War novels is actually very now and very relevant.
Yes, and sadly so. Now, what can you tell us without giving things away about the, you know, kind of the architecture of the plot, where this takes place? What are some of the central themes?
Sure. Well, as I've said already, it is a story of a development of a man becoming a number, if you like. And that is the sort of the arc of this story. It is James Bond killing for the first time and becoming a secret agent. It takes place largely in the south of France, where he is sent on his first mission, which is to look into the doings of a very sinister and grotesque criminal called Jean-Paul Scipio, who is involved in the drug trade, heroin smuggling, a criminal of enormous girth. He was the victim of a vendetta in his childhood and had his throat cut. And although he didn't die, the gland was sliced, and this has caused him to become enormously overweight. And in the course of this adventure, and I think the core and the heart of the book, is his meeting with a woman called 16. That isn't actually a number, it's a French Christian name. And she is an operative from the war. She worked for the English in the Special Operations Executive, which is to say she was a spy behind enemy lines. She is now a criminal working for her own ends. and she allies with Bond, and the two of them become both friends, partners, and inevitably, because this is a Bond novel, lovers. And I think that it is their relationship, what she teaches him. She's older than him, 10 years older than him. She's a great deal more experienced than him in almost everything. And it is what she teaches him and how that relationship develops that I think absolutely defines the book. It incidentally has a title which I wanted to be slightly romantic. Forever and a Day hints of a love story that is at the heart of this book.
Yes, it's a very Bondy title.
I was very surprised it hadn't been used before. Trigger Mortis was a title that divided people. I mean, I know it's a play on words, a pun, and puns, you know, always people either love them or hate them. This time I wanted a slightly less playful title and a one that was more obviously Bond. And once that title had fallen onto the page in front of me, I looked it up on, on the internet and was amazed to find that it hadn't been used before. So I was very happy to use it for this book. It does fit it very well.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Anthony Horowitz, crime novelist extraordinaire, about his newest Bond novel, Forever and a Day. Now, this book, you mentioned 16. There's plenty of machismo in this book, as there must perforce be with 007, with James Bond, but also a very powerful woman and powerful women. And this is something, you know, it's been a long time since I've seen a Bond movie, and I don't think I've ever read one of Ian Fleming's books, I must confess. But he had strong women as well. So could you talk about this kind of counterpoint between, you know, extreme machismo and powerful women?
Certainly. And I want to begin by just saying that one has to always separate the books and the films. The women in the Bond films and the women in the Bond books aren't always the same. And the Bond in the films and his attitude to women is not quite the same as the Bond in the novels and his attitude. So I'm very much in Ian Fleming's world. And the James Bond of the novels is curiously sympathetic to women. I mean, he has a very powerful sex drive. It is undoubtable that he is very attracted to women, and he also is quite forceful with women. But I think he also has great respect for women. I always remind people that in Moonraker, when Gala Brand actually shakes her head and says she does not want to go to bed with him, he doesn't force himself on her. He doesn't try and make her change her mind. He respectfully backs away. And with all the women that he deals with in the Bond novels, he deals with respect. He is not, you know, quite the sexist that some people like to think. In my book, it is very important to me that the women should be his equal and absolutely sparring with him on an equal level. That's partly because, obviously, of the times we live in. This is the Me Too generation and the Me Too times, and I am not going to write characters who fall short of what modern expectations are. At the same time, though, I'm being very careful to be true to the original. So look at characters like Pussy Galore, Tiffany Case, all of the women, actually, in the Bond novels. They are strong, independent, clever. And that, to me, is the right mix for the book, for the woman in my book, 16. In my case, I think she's even cleverer than Bond, but that's because we're at the very beginning of the story. And I have to say that of all the characters in the book, I think I'm proudest of her because she is, you know, I think she is so strong, she is so formidable, and she gives Bond so much. I loved writing about her.
Strong, clever, and beautiful.
Of course. I mean, you know, physically beautiful, yes. I mean, not all Bond women are. I mean, Honeychild Ryder in Dr. No has a broken nose. Bond likes imperfections as well in women. He doesn't go for sort of, you know, the perfect starlet. A character like Pussy Galore in the book, the description of her, is very, very far from the performance in the movie. Honor Blackman was wonderful, but she looked nothing like the character as described in the book. So I never use the words Bond girl, because what I am not doing in these books is creating some kind of package, some kind of objectified creature that belongs to Bond. I think that's, I mean, it may sound a little bit pious and such, but nonetheless, it is what I believe. Which I am married to a very strong woman who runs a production company and frequently hires me. So she's not only my wife, she's my boss. So I am used to writing and talking about strong women. I think in Father's War as well, incidentally. You know, Hilda Pierce, who was the SOE chief, was a wonderful female character to write for, because she was so much a match for Foyle. And I think that having that equality and that sparring and that sense of unpredictability really helps the books.
It certainly makes it more gratifying for female readers.
Well, I'm not sure to what extent women will read these books. I mean, I hope they will, because, as I say, Forever and a Day is, at the end of the day, a love story as well as a sort of a bang-bang action thing. And again, maybe here I'm already sexual stereotyping. Why can't women like that too? But broadly speaking, I've always felt that the real audience for Bond, you know, but I mean, even Fleming himself talked about the books being sort of, you know, pillow fantasies for schoolboys. And that's sort of what was in his head when he wrote them.
Now, maybe it's too premature to ask you, but is there a third Bond novel in the works?
Well, there is a third Bond novel in my head. I will be honest with you. I do have an idea for one. I am the first of the modern writers to be called back once, called back a second time, which was really, you know, exciting for me to have that. I haven't yet heard if the estate would like me to write a third or if the publishers want me to write a third, but let us say that if they come to me, I certainly do have a few thoughts.
Well, that's terrific, and we look forward to that, and Forever and a Day is also terrific. Anthony Horowitz, it's just been such a pleasure to talk with you.
This is the second time we've talked together, and I have to say it is such a pleasure to spend half an hour talking to somebody so enthusiastic about books.
Oh, well, thank you. Crime fiction master Anthony Horowitz. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our previous conversations with him about his books, The Word is Murder, and The Magpie Murders. Next up, an autobiographical collection of stories about a mother, a father, and their autistic son. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The reader knows by page one of Maxine Rosaller's story collection, Queen for a Day, that Mimi Slavitt's 3-year-old son is autistic. But if anyone told her, she wouldn't listen, because she doesn't want to know, until, at last, Danny's behavior becomes so strange, even she can't ignore it. After her son's diagnosis, Mimi finds herself in a world almost as isolating as her son's. It's a world she shares only with mothers like herself. Searching for miracles, begging for the help of heartless bureaucracies, while arranging every minute of every day for children who can never be left alone, they exist in a state of perpetual crisis, normal life always just out of reach. The stories in Queen for a Day are told from the point of view of these mothers, which is actually the point of view of the author, because the collection draws closely on Rosaller's own life with her autistic son. I spoke with Maxine Rosaller about the challenges she confronted as a mother of a disabled child and how those struggles made it onto the pages of her engaging, poignant, and trenchantly funny collection of stories, Queen for a Day. I started out by asking Rosaller to tell us about the central characters in the book, Mimi, Jake, her husband, and her son, Danny.
You know, certainly Mimi is the central character, and it's all about, and you know, the book is very much about her struggles to help her son, and also her struggles with her own grief, and her struggles to accept her son as he is, or just accept the fact that this really is the truth. Jake, her husband, is, you know, has accepted that this a long time ago without telling her. Now they fight a lot and they have a lot of they're very different from each other, but they love each other. So that's sort of that theme actually gets that runs throughout the book, and in the last story you sort of see that they really love each other. The character of Danny is very much based on Benji, my son, who's now 26. And basically it just tells about him and, you know, what he was like and how strange he was and how beautiful and strange. And Mimi struggles to accept that there's something wrong with her son, which, to tell you the truth, I'm still struggling with it in real life.
Let's start with the first story, Sleepwalking Boy. Danny, in the book, is 3. The story is about how the parents deal with his diagnosis, which they find out for the first time. You know, it's a combination of wanting to know the truth and yet really having difficulty accepting it. So talk about that story, Sleepwalking Boy.
It's interesting because first let me just tell you, backtrack a little bit. I wrote this book. It took me 15 years to finish the collection, the book that was published. But originally I wrote it as a memoir. And I wrote this entire memoir, and the first chapter of it was Sleepwalking Boy, which I originally called The Lost Boy. And this was very much based on my experience, although I later fictionalized it because it's funny, like fiction gives you so much freedom. So then I could add all the stuff that wasn't really true. And so it was really true. I mean, that's really what happened is we went and took Benji and this idiot, a psychologist, basically told us there was nothing wrong with him. And because we wanted to believe it, we believed it. But we didn't believe it. We knew it. Our guts. You know, your guts tell you the truth, don't they? So then your head.
Absolutely. I mean, he called it a phase. So what did finding out Danny's diagnosis in the book or your son Benji's diagnosis, what did that mean for you or for the characters in the book? How did that... in other words, I guess I'm asking about labels. How do they liberate and how do they possibly limit?
Okay, I don't think it was liberating at all. I think it was just devastating. And I lived in grief for many, many years. And I'd say months, all I did was cry. But yet, at the same time I was crying, and it's the same, this is Mimi again, and I are the same. I don't think there's really much difference between Mimi and me, except I left, of course, parts of myself out. But I was just devastated, as Mimi was devastated. But yet, in the midst of my devastation, I went right to work, just like Mimi did. And so, really, it was a matter of, okay, this is it, and I've got to get to work. And I'm a very hard worker. And so I just worked nonstop for years, from the moment I woke up until the moment I went to sleep, trying to save my son. And that's what Mimi did, and it kind of killed her. It really devastated her. And she never took a break. And the other thing that really devastated her was, and me too, was holding on to this belief that her son was going to be cured. Because the denial runs throughout the book, and as it did throughout my life with Benji, so I could never really accept it. Because there's this thing called ABA, Applied Behavioral Analysis, and it tells parents it was a 48% chance of a cure. And so I believed this, and so for many years afterwards, I just held on to it. I mean, there's so much involved. When anyone has a disease of any kind, you just cling to this hope, and you have to blind yourself to anything else. And that's what Mimi did. And that's what made it so hard for her to accept her son as he was.
So it sounds to me that you are beyond that, that you have accepted your son as he is. Tell us how that happened.
Well, I wouldn't say that I have exactly accepted him as he is. You know, it sort of amazes me how I was always very much alone in this, as I do address the whole idea of the loneliness of being the mother of a child with a disability. And I felt so lonely in it. Even though my husband was very much in it with me, he was not as emotionally devastated anywhere near so that as I was. And so I was very alone in it, and I felt very devastated. And it's really funny because now, after Benji's graduation from high school, and again, this is not covered in the book, I decided, he had to go to college. Even though, how could he go to college? Because he was in a classroom with 2 aides and 6 kids. But I hired people to go to college with him, and that's what he's doing now. And yet here I am, still believing and still hoping that he is going to change and develop. And so I'm basically working from the same perspective that I did 20 years ago that I do now. As I said to a friend of mine recently, you know, hope springs eternal in the mind of a fool, you know, to make fun of myself, because I just have to believe. And that's, I think, that's, you know, people always have to hope, don't they? They always have to believe that something's going to get better.
It sounds to me like you're putting yourself down, but if on some level you don't accept, then you're really not accepting your kid unconditionally. Your love is not unconditional. And a certainly sense that your love of your son is unconditional. And yet, by hoping for something different, you have allowed him to develop as much as he could. Isn't that true?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, I really do think I've just done an amazing job. I mean, I really do. I mean, I know other women who have done, like, amazing jobs. This is, you know, again, the only time I found out that I wasn't, the only time I really felt not alone was when I started finding this community of people who are doing something called self-direction, where they take charge of their own children's programs. And so, sure, I do believe that. At the heart, I really think, wow, Maxine, you're really, you know, this is really amazing what you've accomplished. But I don't think I really answered your question, did I?
Well, no.
Yeah, okay, so tell me again what you asked me.
So, no, I mean, I think you partially answered it, but what I'm asking is, in not accepting your fate in some mm-hmm. way, you've been able to do that amazing job. And maybe that if you had just kind of accepted it, you know, entirely and thought, well, this is the way he is, it's never going to change, he would not be in college. He would not
no,
be.
No, there's no question about that. But, you know, it's an interesting thing. When Benji was first diagnosed, when I was introduced to the horrible world of social work, and I remember the first time they came to my house, I hate institutions and institutional people. I just wanted them to get out. But I remember meeting one woman, and she had a child with Down syndrome. And she said to me, she said, you know what? Down syndrome is so much easier than autism, because with autism, you never know. And so that's what it is. And so basically, you never know. And so you can, you know, Benji still can develop. He still can, you know, there is still hope for him, although I realized he's never going to, certainly never going to be normal, you know, whatever. But he's not even going to be normal in the sense of just having a social conversation, you know. But my hope for him now is that he find a life that is, you know, find some sort of career that is satisfying for him, and that will, you know, that will make use of his considerable talents and abilities, and also take into account his considerable deficits. So, for sure, I'm working hard, and I'm still working. And I have to say, it's much easier now than it was, because what I've done after, you know, a lot of the book involves Mimi being in contact with these really ugly people, these mean-spirited, ugly people, and her dealing with that and fighting the bureaucracy. But since Benji's graduated high school and he's in college, I've taken complete charge over who's in Benji's life. And I have just found an amazing array of wonderful, beautiful people. I hire people off Craigslist. And I write this great ad, and I attract all these great people. And I'm basically created a utopian world for Benji. That's what I've done. Everyone involved in his life is smart, talented, and beautiful. And if they're not, if they prove themselves to be otherwise, then I just get rid of them. Did I answer your question?
Yes, I think you did. This collection of stories, this novel and stories, is titled Queen for a Day. I remember Queen for a Day.
Yeah, I know. It's nice. Isn't it nice when you find someone as old as you are?
Yeah.
Don't you feel like we belong to a club?
Exactly.
And we have a disease called mortality. It's called, like, disintegration.
Right, well, but luckily, in some ways, you get better as you get older. But Queen for a Day was, you know, I remember being fascinated by the, you know, horrendous stories of the women who are featured on it. Tell us, for I'm sure our many listeners who don't know what Queen for a Day was, tell us what that is. And why did you title this collection that? And it's also the title of story.
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, I'm no good with titles or names. And so I sort of don't, that's the last thing I do. Usually what I do is when I name my characters, I usually use the names of the people on whom they're based. And then, you know, I do change these characters, so I'm not, but I do always have someone in mind. And so what happened was the evolution of Queen for a Day was in this story, which I entitled Queen for a Day, is I'm, you know, writing. And it's lots of times when you're writing, you end up, you're in the story, so it's almost like you're not writing a story, you're just sort of like being in the story, right? And so I'm trying to deal with this character's problems if she wants to go away. How can she get away? And then it just pops into my mind, oh, you can go on Queen for a Day because they offer free vacations. And then, you know, and then the irony of it was so extreme. It's so ironic when you remember, okay, now I'm going to tell everyone what this Queen for a Day was. Queen for a Day was this disgusting show, which some people really loved. It's almost like it was a precursor, I guess, right, to the reality shows, because it had these three women telling their horrible stories, and the most pathetic woman would win the prize, and she would get, you know, the audience would applaud, and then she'd sit there crowned with flowers, like buried in flowers, and, you know, here she is being rewarded for her suffering. It's really horrible. You know, she's just kind of like exposing herself and all her suffering, and basically, I'm an object of pity. Please pity me more than that woman next to me. And so it's ironic, and, you know, the characters in Queen for a Day, Mimi and then Amy, you know, they say, gee whiz, you know, we really are Queen for a Day. You know, we really could have been on that show. And when I think of it, you know, as a little girl watching that show and being repulsed by it, disgusted by it, although I know I have a friend who, she said, I loved that show. And I said, oh, I know why you love that show, because you love crying. And she said, yeah. So anyway, so that's how, so then when my editor said, well, what do you want to call the collection? I said, gee, I don't know. And I said, I guess Queen for a Day. But I guess Queen for a Day is probably a good title for it. It's an ironic title. Although after I named the collection, I found out that Queen for a Day is all over the place. There are like you know, there are creams for it. It's apparently used a lot.
Now, you've been talking about some of the evil people and the evil people in this book and that you experienced in your life. What you're talking about is the SPED, the special education bureaucracy, which, what you've experienced just seems terrible. And so tell us first about that bureaucracy and then the advocates who have kind of flooded in to, in some ways, really exploit the failings of the bureaucracy and the fears and desperation of the parents of autistic kids.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I ran into one of Benji's mentors. I call them mentors on the subway yesterday. And it's interesting. A lot of people that I've hired have gone on to, you know, they were artists originally, and then they've gone on to the social services field because of, you know, their work with Benji. And he was telling me about the whole, you know, the system with the, you know, the shelters. And it's all the same. The social services system is so corrupt. And somehow, they somehow weed out all the good people, and all that's left are these people who are really mean, and they want to get you. And I know this sounds very extreme, but believe me, this was my experience. And so they almost like, it's like they don't want to give you the money. It's as though it's their money. So there's that one aspect of it. They were very cruel to me, and I'm very sensitive to people's cruelty. I really can't bear it. And so it was very hard for me. And also, I don't know, I'm not like a professional kind of person, so I don't really know how to deal with people on any level but on a personal level. So it was always very horrible for me. And also, I don't like asking people for anything. And so here I am, you become a beggar. So there was that one aspect of it, dealing with this ugly, ugly bureaucracy, where I would talk to someone and they would say, well, Ben, if you want that many services for your son, then he belongs in an institution. On the other hand, they'll look at him and say, well, he's so smart, he doesn't really deserve services. So it was just an horrific experience. But even more horrific than that was dealing with this advocate who really completely screwed me, just like in the story, you know, the story of Annie Sullivan. I mean, this was really true. Now, in order to write her character, I couldn't write her as pure evil because that doesn't really work in fiction. And also, you don't really have enough perspective if you just, if you're just ensconced in hate. So I interviewed this woman, and that's, you know, so I interviewed someone else and gave her a whole other backstory on the woman, you know, the story, the beginning of the story tells about this woman who was fighting for her son. So I would say that really the worst part of that experience for me was really dealing with someone who was supposed to help me. Not only did she not help me, but she humiliated me. So it was really insult to injury. It was funny, early on, got on the phone. As soon as, after Benji's diagnosis, I was on the phone from the moment I woke up until the moment I went to sleep, trying to find out what to do with Benji. And one of the people I spoke to, most of the people who take care of their children are women, but this man told me it's going to be worse dealing with the Board of Education than it is dealing with the autism. And how could I ever believe that? But it's true, because there's something about, you know, to use another cliche, it's rubbing salt in a wound. To deal with cruelty when you're expecting kindness is very, very bad. And as I also write in the book, cruelty masked as kindness is the worst kind of cruelty of all. That's also what I encountered. So it was ugly. And it was even uglier than how I portrayed, I think.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Maxine Rosaller about her collection of stories that follow the life of a family with an autistic son. It's called Queen for a Day. The final story I found very poignant. Danny and Jake go on a bike ride. Mimi is incredibly apprehensive about this. Danny is already now, I guess, in high school. And it's really a story about independence. You know, Danny's wish for independence. Jake wants to give him a chance to do that, and Mimi finds it so hard to let go. Talk about that story, and did this actually happen?
Well, that was my favorite story in the collection, but the bike path. And actually, that's the story of my depression and my grief that set in, and it was a very, very hard story for me to write. I remember I was really blocked on that story. I would read Flannery O'Connor is one of my favorite writers. And in order to unblock myself, I would read, I think A Good Man Was Hard to Find. I'd read it over and over again. And then I would sort of, like, phrases would pop into my brain about, for the story. And, no, that didn't really happen. Benji wasn't in an accident. But, yeah, no, I mean, I really, that was my favorite story in the collection, because I feel like it was really about, really got down to Mimi's grief, and it really talked about how hard it was for her and all her fears. And her fears were all centered around her husband for some reason, losing her husband, because she was so afraid to be alone with Jake. Because she just felt so incapacitated after all she had done. She'd just broken herself. She's broken.
Alone with Danny.
With Danny, yeah, right.
Yeah, so, but she's also afraid for Danny, isn't she?
Well, she's afraid for Danny throughout. Her fear for Danny is overwhelming. Her fear for Danny, as it still is for me, is what is going to happen to Danny. As soon as your son is diagnosed with something, well, what's going to happen when he's grown up? And then you say, what's going to happen when I'm dead? So her fear for Danny is, you know, dominates her entire life. But there was also a fear of losing Jake, her husband, because she couldn't do this alone. And also, she loves Jake, and she's filled with irrational fears. So that's what happens. So she has this irrational fear. She doesn't want her son, her husband, to leave the house because she's afraid of losing him. Because that's how alone she feels and how desperate. The depression and loneliness can really cut you down to where you're just nothing, and you're just a bundle of fear. And that's really what I wanted to express in that story. And I think I did accomplish it in the end. And the idea of the accident just sort of occurred to me in the process of writing the story.
You know, we live in a time where the rate of autism is skyrocketing. I think I saw recently an estimate that if things keep on going the way they are, something like one out of three kids will be born somewhere on the autism spectrum. So I wonder if you could You know, if you had one piece of advice to give somebody who was just, their kid is just being newly diagnosed, what would it be?
Well, I think I'd have like a few pieces of advice. One piece of advice I would give to mothers, and it's really always the mothers, and this was the piece of advice that was given to me that I never followed, is you have to take care of yourself. I didn't take care of myself at all, and people told me to take care of myself. I still don't really know how to do that. But it's really important to do that, not just for yourself, but for your child and for your other children and for your husband. Because if you wear yourself down to the point of, you know, to the point where I wore myself down, then you're going to die an early death. You know, we know that mothers of children with disabilities have shorter lifespans. They really do. You know, and then the other thing is you really have to gauge what you're capable of. And don't blame yourself. Because I know, like in the story Queen for a Day, for example, Amy, the main character, runs into this woman on the... It starts off with this woman on the subway and this, you know, businesswoman, and she's just in grief. She's crying, and she sees Amy on the subway, and she tells her how she left her son. And, you know, and then I asked Amy, you know, the character says, well, how do you feel about that? And she says, I don't judge anyone anymore. So I would say don't judge yourself, because you just can do what you're capable of doing. But if you're, you know, so that's what I have to say also. You have to do what you're capable of doing. But if you are capable of taking care of your child in the way that he needs to be taken care of, then don't trust the system. Don't trust it. And don't be afraid of it. And you have to do your own research, and you also have to, the only people who are really going to tell you the truth are other parents. They're going to be your best resource. And don't trust the experts. And I don't really know where the field stands now in terms of the experts. I don't know if there are any people who really know anything, but maybe they do. I don't know. So I think that's what you have to do, and I think that you have to really gauge who you are and then do what has to be done. But really, take care of yourself. Don't trust the authorities. Figure out what you're capable of, and if you're capable of doing what needs to be done, then rely on other parents. And then I do want to give one piece of information to parents, and it depends what state you're in. But for years, I always did all the work myself, okay? Always hired all the people. However, I did it through the agencies, and the agencies pay nothing, and they care nothing. They don't care. Most of them don't care. I don't want to, you know, they mostly don't care, and they rob you blind. They charge like $40 an hour, $39 an hour, and they pay their workers $11 an hour. Now, if your state has something called self-direction, then you can take charge of your child's budget and hire the people yourself and pay them like $20 to $25 an hour and get a much higher quality of person working with your child and really make your life much better, because you're surrounded by people who care rather than people who don't care. So I could write a book about that, which I'm not going to.
Well, that's great. That's great advice. Yeah. Maxine Rosaller, your novel in stories is Queen for a Day. It's just a terrific book on so many levels. And thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, it's just a pleasure talking to you, really.
Maxine Rosaller. Her fiction and nonfiction have been published in the Southern Review, Glimmer Train, Witness, Green Mountains Review, and other literary magazines. Stories of hers have been cited in editions of Best American Short Stories and Best American Essays. To read an excerpt from Queen for a Day, go to writersvoice.net. This is Thanksgiving week, a time of observing traditions. We have a tradition on Writer's Voice of airing an interview that we did a long time ago with Native American storyteller Marge Bruchak about the real story of Thanksgiving, where the Wampanoag Indians helped the English colonists to survive. We don't have time this year to air the entire interview, but we do have time to play the part where Bruchak tells us an Abenaki legend. And you can go to writersvoice.net to hear the whole interview if you like. One of the reasons the English colonists survived is that the Wampanoag showed them how to grow corn. Marge Brushak is a member of the Abenaki tribe. She told us her people's story of how they were given corn.
The story that we have in Abenaki territory talks about corn as a young woman who comes in the middle of winter during a starving time. And when she comes to the people, she's very tall and very lean. She has a long green dress that rustles when she walks. And she asks for a place to stay through the winter. And the people take her in, and they give her room in a lodge, and she sleeps with four grandmothers. And she spends the whole winter with the people. And through that winter, she can't speak their language, but she learns a few words. She listens to the story. She watches how the old care for the young and how the young care for the old. And when spring comes, she gathers those people together. And she says to them that she is grateful for the way they have cared for her, even though she is a stranger. She is grateful for the way they have treated her like a sister. And she has a gift to give to them. And she tells them to give them this gift, she will have to die. And the people say, oh no, sister, you don't have to die. We have good medicine people. We can cure you. And she says, no, no. When I die, you will take my body and you will lay it in your fields. You will pile the earth over it and you will watch that place and my gift will come to you. And so with heavy hearts, the people do as they have been asked to do, and they take that woman's body and they lay it in the fields, and they pile the earth over it, and they watch, and they wait. And when spring comes on, a small green plant grows out of that place, and it is just the color of that woman's green dress. And it keeps growing. And as that plant gets a little taller, it has leaves that come out and they rustle, the way that woman's dress used to rustle when she walked. And the plant keeps growing. And when it gets to be as tall as that woman was tall, it grows seed pods on the side. And from each of those seed pods is hanging long strands of sandy brown hair, like that woman's hair. And when they peel open the seed pods, there is the gift. And this is the food she gives to them. And so the people right away, they give thanks, Vemkikta, Kikta, Olioni, to the earth and sky for helping that plant to grow. They give thanks to that woman for coming to them. They give thanks to all of the grandmothers for looking after that woman like she was their own kin. And there's a song that goes along with that. It's called the Green Corn Song. And it's usually sung in four parts, thanking the four grandmothers that looked after that woman. And it kind of goes like this. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes. Olalikikwehawanneo, 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 Olalikikwehawanneo.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.